Local Government Committee is called to order, being 4:30. Now that we have a quorum. First bill on the agenda is Abler Bill, Senate File 740. There he is, Representative Abler. Representative Diskin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 740 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, Elections, Technology, and a whole bunch of other good stuff.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's a technical amendment in your packet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I see there's an amendment here, the A1 amendment.
I can describe it.
Go ahead.
To describe it.
Why don't we move it first?
That's fine.
Yes, Mr. Representative Diskin.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like to have it.
Let's vote on the amendment. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Abler, see your bill is amended.
The amendment was technical. It was meant to make it permissive for the county, not required. So the site said that was a necessary thing. Am I doing something?
Can you check if there's any feedback here? Maybe the volume button? Turn the volume down a little bit.
Oh, there it is.
It's just ringing in my ears, yeah.
Can you hear me at all? Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. I'm not sure how much testimony you want, but I'll give you the overview of this project. And actually, it's two projects combined. Representative Morgan is in a different committee, so he won't be here talking about the Dakota County portion. This is actually two pilot projects using the design-build method to build a bridge in Ramsey and then a project in Dakota County. And I presume that you've been briefed by Mr. Representative Morgan on the details of his project. I can speak to the idea of using this project for why it's important to the city of Ramsey. That's my forte on this. And then I have the mayor along and the city administrator if you have questions about the technical part. I know that design build is controversial. I'm here as a healthcare guy to talk about building a bridge. So you know where I'm going to take the complexity, the answer is not, which is why I have people who know the details of it. But in terms of the local need, there are two main problems. One problem is the fire department has to cross tracks that are at grade, and they send a guy out to see if the train's coming or not. There's 70 or 80 trains a day on this path, and so interrupted egress is not unusual. And so the mayor might talk about that a bit more. The other part has to do with there's a phenomenon that, actually a non-phenomenon, which was to be called the town center, and it's more like the town Iraq wasteland. Right now, it's piles of sand, and there's a few buildings. It's supposed to be this billion-dollar project, and the developer, did he die and go broke, or go broke and die? So the city recently rescued this project out of the foreclosure using leveraging some city funds, and it's thought that the attention, this is a real bottleneck for getting across the Highway 10 a highway that's just next to the train tracks that you may have seen on the, if you have the materials on the specific thing. But the thinking is if we can draw a good developer in here, this would actually create considerable amounts of jobs, not just for the bridge, but actually for the project, half a billion or more, which would all be done privately. There's been some concern that at some point the city of Ramsey is going to seek state funding for this project, and that's absolutely not true. It's not on the list of projects that they're working on now. It's considerably west of where Highway 10 is being developed, and just to get that out of the way. But this is mainly for two reasons. One is the public safety, and then for the development purposes, which I think could be considerable, and to resurrect this important project. So how much do you want to know, Mr. Chair?
Why don't you let the testifiers give us a little bit of information. I think a few people have questions. I've got a couple questions that I want to make sure of. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Bob Ramsey, the mayor of Ramsey. I want to thank you all for having me today. This project, the long and short of it is we rescued a $35 million project that needed a $25 million bridge. There's no access to get, obviously, you're crossing the train tracks constantly, and it's constantly trained. traffic stacks up the public safety issue. There's a multitude of things that this bridge will do for the city of Ramsey, not even just the city of Ramsey, points north of the city of Ramsey, to be able to get across this grade-to-grade crossing. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I can assure you that we have not requested any type of state or even stimulus money for this, and we won't. This is something that we need to be able to move forward on this bridge. If we start seeing this development happening like we expect it will, we'll find ways of getting funding this bridge.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Representative Biskin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Abor, maybe you can answer this question. If not, Mr. Chair, I believe maybe Representative Beard could. Representative Abor, is this design-build language that we have in this bill identical to what the design-build language that we already have in place for MnDOT?
Representative Abler?
I can answer partly, then I'm going to phone a friend. I think anybody as a staff would give a good answer about that. But the language in here has mirrored the Hartman language that was about how a county would do it. The MnDOT proposal is separate. Beyond that, I think you want to ask somebody. You know, offhand. I know people in the audience know, and maybe staff might know.
Ms. Dyson, would you...
Mr. Chair, I was just looking through to see if I had any notes on that. I'm going to take a guess that it's similar to Hennepin County, but I don't have the information at hand. I'd need to look into it.
Representative Beard, I think you've got your hand up there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have a bill that we're carrying that for MnDOT that is similar to this to an extent, but I do see that Mr. Werke is behind me here in the audience that could probably give Representative Biskin exactly the answers he's looking for with a little more authority.
Mr. Werke, would you like to come to the table and be the phone-a-friend? Please state your name for the tape. And
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Werke. I'm the Highway Division Director for the Minnesota Chapter of Associated General Contractors. Representative Biskin, answer to your question is that the foundational basis for this bill is largely representative of the MnDOT statutes for design build. There are some slight variations as it relates to the, I guess what I would refer to as the sophistication level of the local owners in this case. On page 2 at the bottom about an information session for municipal engineers, I saw some other things in here, but basically it takes the MnDOT two-stage process where a request for qualifications is issued and evaluated, and then a request for proposals is also issued for those proposals deemed qualified to propose on the job. So I would say, as a general cut, this represents the base trunk highway design build statute. One other comment, Mr. Chairman. From our perspective as contractors in the state, it is very important that the process be uniform, and this process reflects that, so that we do not end up in the state with 87 counties using a different process, or multiple municipalities should that authority be granted, which currently it is not. But that's a concern for our members, that there be one process.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abor, I'm going to applaud you for bringing this forward. And you're bringing it forward in a pilot project. I do believe that there are some things we've learned from the MnDOT design build, and that learning is reflective in this bill. And yet, there might be some things we can learn further, and to do that on a pilot basis is much better than throw it wide open for everybody and then find mistakes. So I would support this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Biskin. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had just a little question. We know that MnDOT can do this. Is there anybody else who currently can use design build, any cities or counties currently that are able to use this?
I see Representative Beard waving his hand here. I think he has an answer. We'll use his expertise.
I can channel through whoever she asked the question to, I suppose, but I know that the University of Minnesota can use it. And a couple of years ago, this body passed a bill that allowed MNSCU and the Department of Administration to do pilot projects, Representative Scalzi, for a period of, five years, they could do up to 15% of the project, so a bonding project, state bonding projects, could be done on the design-build basis for building and rehabilitation projects on the, that kind of infrastructure. To my knowledge, by the way, I don't know that we've done a single one yet that's not in a building mode for a structure like a stadium or anything, but we've done several highway projects.
Representative Scalzi, that is.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering also, I mean, that is interesting. I was also wondering if Hennepin County or Ramsey County has done this or has the ability to do it, but thank you.
Hennepin, Mr. Chairman, Hennepin does, I'm told, but I don't know that we've given Ramsey the, I think that's the thrust of Representative Horton, so it's making its way through the system.
I've got a couple questions here, too, Representative Abler, and I talked to you about these beforehand, but I also serve on the state the Transportation Committee, and the concern we have here that we don't earmark projects and transportation. And just want to make, I heard him say that they're not going to be coming back and asking for state dollars. The concern I would have is if we grant this, jump us ahead on the stiff list that we have for state transportation projects, and if this would is a way to get around going through the transportation and the normal transportation funding process.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. I can restate it. Maybe the administrator from the city wants to comment as well. The earmark question, first of all, it does point out a project, but only in terms of how it may be built. Earmarks are more traditionally considered like you're buying something with money. There's no money and no duty from the state to come forward with any money. And the likelihood of them offering any money for this is so remote, I can't tell you what the chance would be. We're lucky to get the 39 Highway 10 quite a bit ways east of this. There's many projects with a higher priority for state money along the way, and this is 40 years, I would guess, at which point this bill will be moot. But the city does not intend or they're not seeking state money, and that's not at all on the list. And so to the earmarking thing, this allows a process to go forward, which we think may speed up the process to help out with the public safety issue, which is a problem every day, and also with a chance to get a developer in there to give the whole project the vitality to create the building jobs and actually to create this economic center that the city of Ramsey would very much like to have. Is that sufficient? Do you want more?
Thank you, Representative Abler. Any more questions on the bill? Representative Stern.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Abler, with this design build, I mean, how much quicker would it be by doing this way versus going through the regular process, and then the cost savings as well? I mean, what's the difference between a typical process and doing it this way?
I'm going to defer to my administrative
manager. Representative Abler, can you please state your name for the tape? And
yes. My name is Kurt Ulrich, City Administrator of the City of Ramsey. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in regard to the process itself, under a non-design build, typical sequence design has been built, it's about a four-year process. And in talking to the county engineers, that could be brought down to about a two-year process if it was done as design build. The major savings is in time and the savings associated with cutting a project from a four-year to a two-year project. The actual dollar savings, there may not be a dollar savings in the cost of the project. In fact, it could potentially be a little bit higher, but the value to the city of moving this project along quickly is enhanced by the fact that we have made a major investment of public monies in purchasing the land around the town center for $6.75 million, and for economic development reasons, it's important to the city, and it's also a cost savings to us if we can get the land more viable sooner. So the speed of the project is very important to us for that reason.
Representative Fair.
Yes, I guess my other question would be, would you still get competitive contractor bids on the project, or are you assigning it to a contractor who does architectural work or design right at the beginning with it?
Mr. Ulrich or whoever?
It would be our intent to follow the design-build process and seek proposals and to try to get the best value based partly on competitive bids, but partly on the on getting someone that could design and build the project.
Okay. Any more questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak either for or against the bill? Come on down. Please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Mike Hawthorne. I'm the business manager for the Minneapolis Building and Construction Trades Council. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this moment. Simply put, I represent about 16,000 workers, and we like to pour concrete and we like to build buildings. And that's why we would be in support of this bill. To hopefully, at this point in time, we're also looking at double-digit unemployment with a lot of our members. We would support anything that could help also spur create some jobs for some of our members and also spur development in that area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hawthorne. Representative Abler, do you have any closing remarks? And
no, I thank you for the attention to the detail. I think it's been a good discussion, and I hope that we can earn this, the support of this and move it on.
Thank you. Again, does anyone else want to speak for or against? If not, Alden Biskins, did you have, Biskins renews his motion that House File, or excuse me, Senate File 740, as amended, be passed and re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. I'm not going to repeat the whole name. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much. Next bill on the agenda for today is House File 1670, Representative Mariani. Get up there at the table and... Representative Hilty, do you want to move the bill?
I would, Mr. Chair, move that House File 1670 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, Technology, Reform, and Elections.
That whole long name, yes. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Mare, the bill's in front of us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you,
describe
Mr.
your bill. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My first time in this particular committee, so it's good to be here. Members, this bill is really basically a technical clarification of current law that more currently reflects what the legislative intent was and continues to be in the law. And it has to do with legislative intent in regards to keeping rents affordable when public funds are used to subsidize those housing developments. The principle here, members, is that a promise exists between an owner / developer and the public taxpayer that promise is created to ensure that that housing remain affordable during the life of the public investment. The language before you more clearly provides that when that the use of public assistance in housing development does not impair the local entity from enforcing affordable rent. It also clearly identifies what's meant by public assistance to the developer or owner to include things like direct subsidies, low-interest loans, tax credits, bonds, infrastructure development. Basically, what this language would do is help the public hold developers and owners accountable for that promise that they make in exchange for public assistance relative to affordable housing. And with that, I'll stop, Mr. Chair and members. I'll ask Councilwoman Amy Island from, I hope I pronounced it right, Amy Island from, Councilwoman from Roseville to explain further what we're trying to do here and to speak to you more directly, I think, about a particular issue involves a lot of which helped to arrive this legislation.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Ireland. I'm a member of the Roseville City Council, and I appreciate being able to offer my testimony today. And this is partly because, I think, for reasons I'll explain, this is good public policy, partly because the city of Roseville had a recent instance where the city granted tax-exempt conduit financing to a particular project on the condition or with the understanding that it would be used to renovate an apartment complex to maintain affordable rental housing in Roseville. So affordable housing is a really important policy priority for local governments, whether they're cities, counties, school districts, other local governments, and I'm sure this committee maybe has heard a little bit about that before. A range of affordable housing is really essential both for economic growth and development and also so that we've got livable communities that people want to be a part of. And in addition, cities in the metro area have got regional affordable housing goals set by the Metropolitan Council. So sometimes, I think increasingly, in order to create incentives for private property owners and developers to actually provide that affordable housing in the private market, local governments are going to use public assistance of the kind that this bill describes. And the amendment is going to apply only in the limited circumstances where there is a grant by the city of public assistance. And as Representative Mariani explained, in those cases, the city government or county government will be granting the public financing, public funds, public money, in direct exchange for a promise that the affordable housing public policy goal is going to actually be met by this private development. So what this bill does, it clarifies the power, and I think we've already got an obligation as local governments when we're giving public assistance to make sure that the affordable housing actually occurs, actually provided. And this is going to give, this bill clarifies the power of cities and local governments to make those public assistance incentive programs actually work. And it's going to limit that power to essentially oversee affordable rents to cases where the public assistance is actually ongoing. So there's language in the bill that also makes clear that this is for the life or a period of time consistent with the term of the public assistance. So, for example, if you've got bonds, it would be consistent with that. If you've got tax increment financing, it would be, well, the TIF district is paying out or is active. And I think the public policy reason, I think that this is such a good idea, clarifying the power and ability of local governments to do this is going to actually give us an ability to create meaningful public assistance incentives that make affordable housing happen in the community. And I think that is good for everybody. It's good for the local government because we need our public policy goals and achieve those efficiently. I think it's good for the local residents that are going to benefit from the affordable housing. It's going to benefit the businesses that have places for their workers to live. And I think also it will benefit the private property owners and developers that want to get public assistance for these types of projects, because it's going to give the local governments enough power, enough teeth to be assured that they will get, in exchange for those precious public dollars, they're going to get affordable housing provided through the private market. And I'd be happy to take questions if members of the committee would like
to. Thank you. Representative Dixon, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of them. Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, you know, in the big picture, I can support this legislation. I mean, if I, as a landlord, am going to have my hand out, then there are going to be some strings attached. I get that, all right? If I'm going to be a landlord, I don't want to be caught in some unexpected web either. So just a few clarifying questions, Representative Mariani. If I, as a landlord, rent out to somebody who is receiving food stamps, am I now caught in a web here where my rent is, the amount I can rent is now dictated to me by the statutory home rule charter city at home?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bisson, I don't think, I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, but I don't think that the nature of the individual's circumstances are going to determine the rent. Those are standards that are entered into with full understanding between the developer, owner, and your local jurisdiction relative to, and I'm not sure how, I know that there are metropolitan affordability standards that are set, I believe, by through the form of the Met Council. But the point is that my understanding is that the landlord, developer, owner isn't subject to arbitrary changes in terms of affordability, that those are understood while the actual rate may not fix, the mechanism for determining affordability is understood at the beginning when the stipulation is entered into between the local and the developer. At least that's my understanding. And it's certainly not my intent, Mr. Chair, further, that we subject owners to arbitrary shifting.
Representative Hilty, was this a point? Is your question to this point? Or?
What was, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilty, then.
Representative Biskins, I think what you were asking is if a tenant in this property were receiving public assistance, would that apply? Would this provision apply? But as I'm reading it, it says property to which it's providing public assistance. I don't think it would extend to tenants. If I'm misunderstanding that, perhaps Ms. Dyson could shed some light on that.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair, I was reading it the same way as Representative Hilton, that the provision is saying to manage or control property to which it is providing public assistance, so that the public assistance is qualified by the fact that it's provided to the property. And then the following sentence, the direct subsidies, would again be related to subsidies for the property.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, and it's good to have that on the record, all right? That's important. The other two pieces that I do have questions on are the issue of tax credits. A number of properties, here at the legislature, for different times, different seasons, different reasons, we provide property tax credits, et cetera. And so I hope there's not a catch-22 here, all right, that as a landlord, I'm not going to be able to take a property tax credit that the state is offering simply because by taking it, I could now be subjected to management of my property, management and control by the statutory or home rule charter city. And then the third piece I have is the infrastructure development. If I own a rental unit and the city makes a decision to redo the curb and gutter and sidewalk in front of my place of residence, typically or rarely does a municipality fully assess 100% of that cost. There's an amount of the cost that is picked up by the residents that directly benefit, but there's also an amount of that cost that the municipality picks up under the general welfare of the community at large. And so I'm concerned that the words in infrastructure development could capture me now, all right, and where my property is under the control of the city.
Mr. Chair, Vistas, I think we're going to send this as why are we trying to lay out legislative intent here. I think it's important to be clear that on that latter point, we're not talking about prescriptive improvements, infrastructure improvements. We're talking about public subsidies, of which one of them could be infrastructure development, as agreed to between the developer and the local entity as a condition for the subsidy and for the affordability issue. So I would say that our language here is not about subsequent improvements that would then trigger those kind of control issues. And I would argue the same thing with subsequent tax credits. So the issue here goes to the original agreement between the developer and the city in the form of these public subsidies that are agreed to at that point in time. I think it's important to get the legislative intent on the record.
Representative Beard, you had a question.
Nope, no, Representative Dixon's asked them all, so I have nothing else to add.
Okay. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Dixon's asked most of mine, too. I just have one other question, just a clarification. I mean, it's already in the law here, I see, in the line right above. But what does it mean to manage or control property?
Representative Bennett Mariani? Or Ms. Island?
I'll take a stab at it. I think that in the context of providing the kind of public assistance this law is talking about, that manage or control would refer to the ability of a city or local government to enforce compliance with conditions in a development agreement that provided for those types of public assistance aimed at getting affordable housing. It, to me, does not refer to the city taking over the management in the sense that the city would be running the development, but rather that the city has got the power to control the terms of the agreement that form the basis for the public assistance, which is designed as an incentive to provide the affordable housing.
Representative Eastland.
Does Ms. Dyson or somebody else have any other insight into that? I mean, what that would mean? It's a
Ms. Dyson. Do you have any insight in?
Mr. Chair, I have nothing to add to what the witnesses said. Don't have any background on this.
And Mr. Chair, I would note we're not introducing a new concept here. There's evidence on line 1.11 in the current law where you've got the same language being used to manage or control property.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, I acknowledge that, because I see it's already in there. I guess, my question is, there's just a lot of things that are involved in managing property. There's evicting tenants. There's dealing with a lot of a lot of issues that, and I guess I'm just curious if much of that is interfered with. And what is, I mean, maybe a clarification on what affordable rent is as well. I mean, we're trying to guarantee affordable rent, and so that seems to be kind of a key component of this thing from what you mentioned. I guess I'm just curious what rights property owners are going to lose in this issue if for some reason they've taken some kind of a public subsidy. And then they get down the road a ways, and can affordable rent change? I guess those are all kind of questions that I've got.
Ms. Island.
I have a thought on that. It's just to take the city of Roseville's most recent example. Usually if you grant some particular type of public assistance, let's take our example of the tax-exempt bonds, there are both state and federal guidelines that apply to define what's affordable in the context of receiving a tax exemption. There's also a series of state statutes on guidelines that have to be met if state tax credits are going to be received. And usually these are fairly complicated transactions that happen, and so generally the agreement that backs up the bonds or the agreement that backs up the tax increment financing or whatever other type of assistance is going to spell out what legal guidelines apply. So most often those guidelines are coming from some other legal source, and the city is in a position where, on the one hand, we want to be able to make sure those are complied with, and often the city actually has a legal obligation to make sure they are. So in that context, management might just mean the ability of the city to get the information that it needs to know whether those guidelines are being met. So being able to look at rent rolls, being able to look at other documents that the private property manager has. The other thought that I had on the manage and control, cities kind of routinely, when they're enforcing maintenance codes or perhaps enforcing rental housing ordinances, do have certain powers already to come in and perhaps inspect, perhaps require that certain problems get fixed that are causing a danger on the property or that are violating maintenance codes. So that's another kind of piece of it. But this law is designed to apply to privately owned and managed property. So this isn't meant to apply to cases, if there are any, where cities actually run the housing themselves, but rather their ability to supervise them in a way that makes sure that all the legal obligations are met.
Just one final question. Is this what we're doing here in this bill, is this something that is patterned after what other cities do? Is this kind of a one of a kind based on what you see the need and this is how you fix the problem? Is this a common practice that others
need
as well?
To me, this is a more of a clarifying law than creating new powers for cities, because there's already quite a lot of legal framework that governs our ability and our power to give these kinds of public assistance subsidies. And so what this is basically saying is that if the city wants to encourage private development of affordable housing, and we decide that we want to use one of these public tools to do that, then this just clarifies that the city is able then to go in and enforce the agreements that we reach, so that we get, in exchange for that public assistance, we actually get affordable housing that meets the applicable legal guidelines. And a lot of those guidelines are not going to come from the city itself, they're going to come from these other state and federal laws and other policies. But I mean, I think this would allow also cities could I think create their own policy to say, here are the type of situations where we'll consider granting tax-exempt bonds, or we'll consider granting tax increment financing, or we'll consider providing infrastructure that the developer doesn't normally have to pay for themselves. And it just clarifies powers, I think, for the city to enforce those agreements.
So, Ms. Tyler, I got a question. We're talking here, we're not catching somebody in a catch-22 when they're entering into this, the private developer, the manager, owner of this property. They're signing a contract. They know ahead of time that these requirements are going to be on them, and so that they're not being caught. This isn't going to go back and enforce this on existing contracts. This would be going forward, and so the people would know this requirement's on there ahead of time, so they're not going to be walking in and all of a sudden, like, he's being caught in a gotcha.
No, and in fact, this is going to apply up front. So if the private landowner, private developer comes to a city or a county and says, we would like to apply for this type of public assistance, they're going to be negotiating these kinds of agreements before the county government or city government approves those subsidies. And it doesn't apply after the fact, so it doesn't apply to existing projects. And also, there is that division that says it's limited to the term limited to a period of time consistent with the term of the public assistance. So it doesn't go on forever either. So once your bonds are paid off, or once the TIF district has been paid off or is closed, then this law would no longer apply. So it's limited in scope to the public assistance that's granted as well.
Representative Bitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment made by the testifier that I'd like to probe a little bit further, that this is clarifying language. Typically, clarifying language isn't needed unless there has been a question brought forward about the clarity of the language. Is there a specific instance where the clarity of the current law was challenged? And if so, could you share that with us?
It would relate to this recent experience in the city of Roseville, where the city council granted tax-exempt conduit bonds. So it wasn't the city directly bonding for the project. It was one where we essentially allowed the developer to receive the benefit of these conduit bonds. And along with that went a pretty detailed legal agreement about what the conditions were. And one of the conditions was maintenance of affordable rent. And an issue did come up in which some residents were concerned and raised complaints that the rents had been raised by the new owners and the developers as they went along on the renovation project that they had gotten the bonding for. And it turns out that under a separate state statute, it is the city's responsibility as the bonding authority, even in a case like this with conduit bonds as opposed to the city bonding directly, that it's our responsibility to enforce compliance with the conditions of the bond. And so this did come up. And there was a question about, well, what does that power extend to? Can we actually enforce a certain rental rate, or what information is the city entitled to get from the owners and developers and managers in order to make sure compliance is met? So it's clarifying. I think that those other statutes give local governments the obligation to do that kind of enforcement and compliance, but this is clarifying that if we find noncompliance, that there is a way for us to remedy that and to make sure that the conditions are met going forward. So that's why I think it's clarifying. It's not breaking new ground and saying, cities, this is now your power and authority and responsibility, because that's already there as a condition of bonding and tax increment financing and other types of public assistance that we're able to give.
Yep. Any more questions from the committee? Representative Stern.
Coming off City Council at Rosemont, and we've had some affordable housing projects, both, you know, CDA, you know, did a project, and we also had one downtown with some of them. I'm just not getting it why we're doing a statewide law change when it's something that we either through contract or ordinance that we might be able to get at this. We've had really good luck with our affordable housing and, you know, our choice of housing, so it's something I still can't really wrap my hands around with this change right now.
Ms. Island, Representative Mariani.
I'll take a try at it, Mr. Chair. I think it basically is just clarifying that we've got the power as city government to contract and impose those conditions and then enforce them, or that we have the power to make a local ordinance or a local policy that says these are the circumstances where we'll grant public assistance in order to give an incentive for affordable housing, and these are the circumstances where we'll actually step in to enforce those conditions if they're not met by the private parties that agree to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my best answer to that.
Thank you. Representative Kelsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I applaud the Representative Mariani for bringing this bill in to you, Councilmember Island, because I think that this really makes it clear an area which may have a few gray aspects to it. I think that if we can do this in a small way in state statute, I think it's a good thing for everyone coming from local government as well. Then the city does not have to be the overseer. I mean, if it's in state statute, it has a lot more practicality, I think, to the cities.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you. A question there, so.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what this is to the testifier. If you have it in contract, couldn't you just enforce the contract? I guess I'm not understanding where I missed that question already. Sorry, Mark. It seems to me that this language, and maybe this is fine, but this language would allow you to go back and do it by ordinance subsequently, even if it wasn't written into the contract on the front end, or something else. I guess I'm not. The other thing is that it could, in theory, as I read it, as long as there's any existing outstanding public assistance going into a project, you could go back and impose this by ordinance, even if you had it in contract and those terms expired or something. So I'm just confused about how those two relate to each other. I guess I'm not alone, even if I'm
silent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what it does do, and getting back to the Roseville example again, it's true, there's a contract in place and the city does have the power to enforce it. But the one gray area where it arguably would be a conflict or we wouldn't have the power to do it is the fact that this is part of the statute that says generally cities can't impose rent controls. And where affordable housing, a big part of policies for affordable housing is setting guidelines for what counts as affordable. So I think if the city tried to enforce that contract, it's possible, if part of that enforcement action was to say, no, you've got to charge rents to certain tenants within certain ranges that the private party could come back and say, wait a minute, that's rent control. State law does not allow cities the power to do that. So what this does is it creates a really narrow instance where it's clear that where it's conditioned to public assistance, it's okay for the city or county or other local government to take the role of enforcing what could be a restriction on rent, at least in a very narrow context and in a very specific instance. So I think that's why this actually helps clarify that cities can enforce their contracts. And I think it also clarifies that if it's connected to providing affordable housing, that cities could enact an ordinance that sets some general policies about what kinds of rents count as affordable when we're thinking about giving public incentives to provide those.
And Ms. Eilert, so when we're talking here public assistance, we're talking assistance to the developer.
To the developer.
Not as public assistance that we would, as was asked earlier, food stamps or something that we're giving to individuals that would be living in those apartments.
Right. It would be assistance to the developer, property owner, and it would be assistance that's determined at the beginning of the project when they're coming in to get their approval from the local government to go forward and build something, and they're asking for that assistance to be provided. That's when this would apply. And it would sunset again once the specific public assistance was no longer in effect. So I'm not sure it would apply in cases where there's some type of public assistance being granted, only those specific ones that are aimed as an incentive for the affordable housing.
Representative Eastman.
Just one clarification after Representative Winkler brought that issue up. That was a question I had, and I think it kind of materialized when he was talking. So currently, if there is a contractual issue, some kind of an enforcement action could be brought to the court to enforce the agreement of the contract. Is that correct?
I believe that's usually true.
Ms. Eilert.
And I guess that's why I was just kind of feeling a little uncomfortable with the language, because I guess there is something about this that just doesn't sit quite right. I mean, it's like it's all of a sudden giving the city unilateral ability to kind of step in and enforce a contract. Not that that's not justifiable, that's typically not. We don't usually give one of the parties the ability to do that in an agreement. That's you sign the agreement and you move ahead. And if somebody doesn't live up to their end, then there is a mechanism in place where we can file actions to do that. I guess there's a question as to how this could all work, and could it really be a backdoor way to some level of a very narrow level? I think you're right. I mean, but a very narrow level of kind of rent control. I guess I'm. It seems like there's a little bit of a concern that I have with the bill at this point. But
Representative Winkler, do you have another question or?
Well, Mr. Jared, just another kind of definitional question. How long? It says consistent with the term of public assistance. How long is the period of public assistance for infrastructure development? I don't know, if you build a street, how long would that be an assistance, or, some assistance to a project?
Ms. Violin.
That's a good question. One point of clarification, I think when the bill refers to infrastructure development, that's development that would normally otherwise be paid for by the developer that happens when a project is built. So that's usually part of that contract that the city or local government would enter into. I don't really have an answer based on the language here about what would the term be where the subsidy was in the form of infrastructure development, except to say that usually where it is part of the subsidy package, it's usually in connection with either tax increment financing or a bond or some other mode of financing that's going to have a term. So that's where I think the limitation or the time limit would come in. It wouldn't be necessarily forever, but however long it took to pay off the cost of building that infrastructure that would otherwise, and this was a key point for me, normally developers are required to pay for roads, sewers, stormwater improvements that are necessary in order to build their project or to improve their project. So this is talking about cases where the city, in order to give an incentive to provide affordable housing, says, well, you know, we'll actually pay for that, or we'll subsidize it through some means, which otherwise the developer is paying for.
Representative Hilty.
Chair, to that point, I kind of struggled with the infrastructure development question myself, and since a number of members have raised that, I wonder if that could not be clarified by a small addition to the language here, in which we would just add after infrastructure development of a specified term.
Ms. Dyson, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. On page 1, line 16, after development, insert of a specified term.
I'm not moving that at this time, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to throw that out for discussion. I think that might work to get some clarity and some comfort.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Peer, do you have a question?
Here, I like where Mr. Representative Hilty is trying to go with this, but remind us again what the motion is on this bill. Where is it going next?
Going to govern operations.
Okay, so we have an opportunity. Well, that's the committee, of course, where he doesn't like to do repair work, right? Okay, it's coming back to me now. Let me think about it for a minute before I speak anymore.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Mariani.
Well, Chair, Representative Beard, that's my experience there as well, and so if there's going to be a change, I just assume have you all do it here. And we just quickly, obviously we had a lot of time to think about it, we just quickly checked on it with each other here. I think that works. I mean, it speaks to, you know, one of the basic tenets of the testimony here, in which the business acknowledges much, you know, that you have a meeting of the minds at the beginning, and so you're being clear that that meeting of the minds, in fact, happened. There's agreement to that. I struggle too with what the life of an infrastructure investment might be. I think it's a helpful amendment.
Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as we're talking about this, I think what I'm kind of seeing here is that currently what you're saying is there are contractual agreements, mm-hmm. and that what you're looking for is the ability to kind of provide some enforcement to the contractual agreements. There's nothing in here that talks about any contractual agreements. You could actually come in the back door. A public house or a privately owned house could somehow at some point take a public subsidy. And if there was not an agreement written, I guess what is the enforcement then? I mean, you can technically take over and if they aren't providing affordable housing, maybe that wasn't part of the agreement. But yet it was a public subsidy. So it seems like there needs to be a governing agreement that needs to be in place and defined so that you're enforcing something. This is just kind of you're enforcing a lot of stuff based on a public subsidy of some kind. There potentially might not be. I could see a situation in some city, some place where maybe some apartment building got some kind of a public subsidy and all of a sudden they discover this and it's like we could so I that kind of don't we need some kind of a governing agreement that we have to kind of have in place and then there would be the ability to enforce that agreement and only that agreement?
Ms. Island, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that all of the types of public assistance that are specifically defined in the bill would be ones where there would be, you would have to have an agreement with the local government before those types of assistance can be provided. And that's true with bonds. Under the example in Roseville, there had to be an agreement before those bonds could be issued. as tax-exempt bonds. If there's tax increment financing involved, then there's got to be documentation and agreements to go along with that. Infrastructure development, if the city is going to build something, there is always an agreement for the infrastructure improvements that goes along with that before that occurs and before that benefit is granted. So I think you would always have either an agreement or you'd have to have a policy, an ordinance, a statute that you'd be granting the benefit under. So those would be the things that would be enforced.
Ms. Dyson, is there elsewhere a statute that would deal with that? Answer that question.
Mr. Chair, I was actually thinking about a suggested sentence, and I'm sorry I did not hear the witness's testimony.
Is there also in the section of law that deals with contracts or that this stuff is done with contracts? Or?
Mr. Chair, this section of statute does not. I think there is some of the terms like low interest loans, tax credits, bonds, those are all things that have agreements. Infrastructure development is more vague.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was going to offer as a potential option is adding a sentence rather than just a clause of the specified term that says the public assistance must be governed by an agreement between the governmental unit and the developer or owner and specify the term of the public assistance. And that would cover each of the elements, not just the infrastructure development.
Representative Eastman, did you hear that?
I was
going to
be talking.
Okay. Ms. Dyson, you want to repeat that so that...
Sure, I don't think Representative Turner heard it either.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess what I was going to suggest as a clarification is on page 1, line 16, after development, insert a period and then an additional sentence that would read, the public assistance must be governed by an agreement between the governmental unit and the developer or owner and specify the terms of the public assistance.
I think that really that gets to the issue. I'll ask one other question, and then I guess we can just go on with this. As far as I'm concerned, it's not that big of a deal. But the more I look at this thing, the more it looks to me like it's kind of an answer looking for a real problem. Because if there are agreements out there, there already is a mechanism in the courts for enforcing agreements. And what we're doing here is we're taking a specific example, maybe in one city, and we're kind of putting in statute something that is, has kind of a much broader impact than just for their particular need. So I guess I'm just struggling with that kind of a broad brush approach to such a small problem that I think a solution already exists for. And so that's kind of my issue.
Representative Hilty, you had a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in case this is needed, I kind of like Ms. Dyson's suggestion as a modification to the amendment that I kind of floated before, and I would move as an amendment the language that Ms. Dyson just described.
So Representative Hilty moves the amendment. Ms. Dyson, would you want to read that again so that we... So we know we have it in writing.
You do it.
Mr. Chair and members, page 1, line 16, after development, insert a period. The public assistance must be governed by an agreement between the governmental unit and the developer or owner and specify the term of the public assistance.
Representative Mariani, does that...
Okay.
Chair and members, I think it's a good amendment.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative Eastland, I think this is a very helpful amendment, and I think it's not only is it, but I think the point is that you could contract with this, but there can be questions about whether contract terms are enforceable or not. And so if a legal counsel were to interpret a fairly broad grant of, or a broad control of rents in a particular project, they might say, no, that really goes beyond the scope of what is permissible here. And so by putting the specific authorization in statute and tying it to a contract, I think you get at both of those things and give them a little more room to enforce those contract terms.
Any more questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor of the amendment, Ms. Eisen read, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. I see there's somebody else at the table here. Please identify yourself for the tape you had. I wanted to get some testimony.
My name is Marcia Cressy, and I'm I live in Roseville. And I live in apartments that used to be affordable, and that was a neighborhood. And what happened was that new developers purchased the property and got those millions of dollars in tax funds. And because the city was unable to, and so what happened to us was our rent went up a lot. I mean, it was $50 to $175 a unit. My rent went up $114 in this apartment. And so people have lived there for a dozen years and have been don't live there anymore. And because the rents went as high as they could be for the metro level, those apartments are more expensive than all the apartments around where we live, where they got no public subsidies. And so I live in an apartment now, and I'm moving. But I live in an apartment now where my rent went up $114, and there's been no improvement whatsoever in our apartments. There has been on the outside, and there has been some apartments. They put in an office, took out some trees, and but the issue isn't the one developer, like. But when Representative Stern was talking before about in Rosemont how they were very lucky because the developer and the city was able to work together without having it to have to be a problem. Well, in Roseville, when the tenants went and to the city council, it wasn't that simple. And the city council didn't know, or they told the tenants everything from go back to MHFA to go to the IRS to, you know, and to try and resolve this, and that this isn't going to help me today, but it will help neighborhoods to be predictable, where people know that how much rent they're going to pay, and developers or landlords know how much rent they're going to be getting in, and how much development is done, and so that the communities can continue to thrive.
You can wrap up so we can. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I work with an organization of low-income people that worked with the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, and that's why I'm able to be here and able to talk to people here, because of the access that gave us. And when we have members that live in Maplewood and in different places that where the city councils have had the same problem, where people are given tax money and public subsidies are given. And then, in exchange for that, the accountability is hard to find, and so that's why this bill, I hope, will be passed so that it can help my neighbors.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention, Ms. Kresge. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak against the bill? Anybody else would like to speak for the bill? If not, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1670 be recommended to pass.
As amended?
As amended, and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
Technology election reform. Yes.
Reform and election.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bill is passed. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Stirner, you want to move the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I reviewed the minutes and they look great. I'd like to move them as printed, the March 30th minutes.
Discussion of the amendments for March 30th. All those in favor of the minute of passing the or approving the minutes of March 30th, 2009, please say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Those opposed.
All those opposed. with that, this is our last meeting, and I want to thank the pages that have served here in the committee, and it's been a good time in the committee. We may have another meeting if there are some. As far as if there's some informational meetings, but for right now, I don't think we have anything scheduled. But with that, this should be our last meeting, so a motion adjourned, a meeting adjourned.